Welcome to the Inside of the Cross Division 2, Division 3 podcast. I'm Matt Kinnear here with Dan Kaplan. We're doing a late night edition. It's getting close to the end here. We're getting a little loose. We got no agenda. We're just kind of going with it. We've seen these teams for several months now, and we are ready to roll with the championship game. RIT versus Salisbury. This is a rematch. You know, this was the championship game just a few years ago. RIT going for its first national championship and Salisbury going for its millionth national championship. This is, you know, it's funny. It's kind of right where we started, right? You know, Salisbury and RIT, two of the top, you know, maybe the top two or the top three teams, depending on what you thought of tops at the beginning of the season. And, you know, things are, predictions are right in some cases. And that's true here with this matchup. It's going to be a fun one. I know we have some opinions on it. And then there's also an awesome D2 game that's going to be Sunday as well up in East Hartford, Connecticut. Lemoyne versus Lenoir Rhine. And pretty similar there in terms of Lenoir Rhine is a team going for its first championship. Lemoyne is the team that is kind of the grizzled veteran of the national championship game. Dan Sheehan has been there, done that, won it many times. Lenoir Rhine has been a program for 11 years now and going for its first title. And we're going to start out, though, with something different. I wanted to give a quick shout-out. I know the game was about 2 weeks now that you're listening to this, but Nassau Community College winning the JUCO National Championship. This is really significant in terms of I didn't realize it's been so long since Nassau has won this title. Obviously, OCC dominated for quite a stretch there, almost 15 years for this national championship, and Jack Pucci was awesome in this one. He had the game-winning goal. He assisted on the game-tying goal with 5 seconds left in regulation. The MVP, 4 goals, 3 assists. Skylar Wild had an awesome game as well. Congrats to Nassau on that game. You know, the coach, John Savage, after that game, I talked to him last week and did a story for InsideTheCross.com, said that Jack Pucci is the second-best offensive player he has ever coached at Nassau.
Wow.
Answers the first. He's a pro player right now.
I guess Josh Byrne.
Josh Byrne. So he's up there in elite company. He says he's right up there with Josh Byrne in terms of how good of a player he is. So,
wow.
You know, really looking forward to see what Jack does with the rest of his career. Obviously, that's going to start heating up soon in terms of the transfer market and these guys kind of finding four-year schools. And an interesting thing with that game and, you know, the JUCO season this year is it didn't count against eligibility. So, you know, player like Jack Pucci is someone who played, you know, 2 seasons, really 1.5 seasons at the JUCO level and has used 0 years of eligibility. So he could go to a 4-year college. You know, the way I understand it is he probably will have to have a waiver for his last year, you know, to play the more than, you know, the 5-4 rule that they have at that level. But, you know, there's some excellent players out there. So please watch the film if you are looking for a player, because there's some great players out there who are going to be looking for homes and, you know, have done some amazing things at the JUCO level.
Yes, that's right. And they took down the guys from around your neck of the woods and Coach Verardi and the Hartford Community College. I guess they're the Owls, I think.
Yeah, my son plays his little soccer shots that he does on Saturday mornings. He's at the campus of Hartford Community College.
Oh, dang.
Yeah. I've actually seen them warming up sometimes ahead of games. And, you know, they've had a heck of a season. It was, you know, weird with COVID. Obviously, there wasn't a lot of that cross-pollination that there usually is. You know, I know Nassau, its schedule was a lot weaker than normal in terms of they didn't get to play a lot of those early big games that, you know, they used to prep themselves for this moment because, you know, they're a team that wants to win national championships. But they gave it to get through it, you know. They took what was in front of them, and they won that national championship. So shout out to those guys. You know, that read that story on InsideTheCross.com and check out those players. Great story out of Nassau. But let's talk D3 next. Dan, you were in Rochester, and from what I understand, you said you got chirped in a bar in Rochester?
Yeah, so, I mean, the whole trip was awesome. It really was. It was a great time. And, yes, we did get chirped in the bar in Rochester. We were there in, like, a little bit of a waiting period before we got to go and jump to our table. So we just grabbed a couple drinks at the bar while we were waiting. And then as we were on our way out, some wise guy in the bar decided to go, "Oh, yeah, great game by York up there, huh?" And we just kind of took it on the chin. We were really hungry, so I was more concerned about getting my wings than dealing with the guy at the bar. Plus, hey, if they're talking about you, it probably means something.
You're a celebrity now.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Kyle immediately goes, oh, dude, it was probably a Nazareth fan, and you probably deserve it for our rant early in the year. And I was like, you know what? You're right.
Well, the thing was, that was mostly his rant.
So, yeah, but, you know, I'll get association to it. And I do believe I started it because the whole thing, it started because I get these texts from people that go, oh, man, this is going to be a good one, talking about RIT, who's in the national championship and loaded in a total powerhouse, you know, versus Naz. And I'm like, I think you might have to think twice on that one.
Well, let's talk about RIT. You know, they played Tufts in a game that I think everyone was expecting to happen at the time that it did happen in the national semifinals. What was your major takeaway about RIT coming out of that game? Obviously, if you beat Tufts, there's something that's going pretty good. RIT was able to do it. What was the main reason and the biggest factor that you saw to their success in that game?
So after the game, I had the chance to talk to Coach Kuhn, and he alluded to them grinding. And I think he's totally right. He said that in both of those games, which I obviously, you know, I was there for the weekend, so I got to see the Colorado game on Saturday. And he said that he didn't feel like they really started to have any success in either game until the guys started to get a little dirtier and start grinding and start winning the 50-50s. And there's a play, the play that leads to the tying goal is a loose ball up against the far sideline, and Sundown comes in full speed, picks it up, draws a foul on the play as he picks it up, and then from the ground throws it to a D mid, like in rhythm, who catches it on his ear. Now they're pushing the 43 the other way. It gets around the horn, and Dawson Tate finishes it, like catches it on the pipe, looks low and puts it high and just sticks it right in the top corner. And you're like, holy cow, like this team is awesome. But it all started with Sundown's like gritty, grindy play to go and get the ball and, you know, draw that foul, run through it, and get the ball out of his stick. You know, those are the type of plays that ultimately win you championships. And in that instance, it was a semifinal.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point because, like, these teams are all so talented, but it's so easy to forget, like, what it takes at this level. Because every team right now is uber-talented. You know, you're not going to win on talent alone. Maybe RIT is more talented than Tufts, but it's by a fraction. Right. So like, what's going to be the difference there? It's going to be what you can do for those ground balls, what you can do in the middle of the field. You know, who's going to want it more? I know it's cliche, but
totally. I know we're going to get there a little bit and touch on it, but that Lynchburg CNU game, in the preview going into that, I said, you know, the difference in that game is going to be the little things. It's going to be, you know, who can take care of making sure that they clear 100%. Who can capitalize on as many opportunities as they can, you know? Who can come up with as many 50-50 ground balls as possible? You know, there's an instance where it's a 50-50 shot, two people are sprinting to the sideline, who's going to dive? You know, who's going to win you that extra possession? It comes down to those little things. And, you know, that was an incredible game that ended in overtime. And, you know, when it comes down to a game like that where it's every little thing is a hinge point.
So we are in the thick of May Madness. It doesn't get any madder than this, so to speak, you know, going into the championship game. We're going to have a ton of lacrosse this weekend, you know, starting with the women's D1 games on Friday afternoon, moving into the men's D1 semifinals, and then we have the D2 and the D3 championship, and then, you know, we have the women's championship as well, and then we have the men's D1 championship on Monday. What a crazy weekend. What an awesome weekend to be, you know, whether you're up in East Hartford or you're on the couch. May Madness is officially here. The new Maverick EKG shoulder pads and chest protectors are in stock for all players. Get upgraded performance protection that meets the NOXI safety standards. Shop the whole line at lax.com/EKG. Thank you to Maverick for being our sponsor of May Madness. You can see all their stuff on insidethecross.com. You know, click the ads and check out what Maverick is doing right now. Some awesome stuff in terms of, you know, the commotio cordis protection there. Now, let's get back to this, and we'll start with RIT and go a little more in-depth in RIT. What is the one area of the field that is most crucial for RIT to be successful against Salisbury?
Great question. And I think that more than people realize, the RIT offensive midfield deserves so much credit for the RIT offensive success. Like, their attack is obviously so skilled between Kamenot, Dawson Tate, and Sundown, and Spencer Bell, who kind of rotate and fill different spots and are very similar players but kind of complement each other in different ways. And so the RIT staff finds a way to get them both some touches and both on the field. And so those guys are incredibly slick and skilled. But the RIT midfield of Rosenblum, Barnable, and anybody else that they want to throw out there with those two, but this weekend it was Marley Angus, you know, those three are incredible. And Rosenblum and Barnable get you spinning, and they force you to have to slide to them, because if you don't, they're going to score unassisted goals. You know, when they're a team that those two guys are scoring unassisted goals and you have to slide to them, their attack is just so slick behind it and so skilled that once they get you rotating, you're in trouble. And so you have to do whatever you can to just own your matchups in the middle of the field, which I think, you know, when we're going to get there with a little bit of a preview to the game, but Salisbury does this, you know, double pull and short stick shut down at the attack just by nature, and has been for years, you know, so that kind of is going to be a really, really interesting matchup, is that RIT offensive midfield and then going against that double pull of the Salisbury defense.
Now, I want to clarify one thing. When you say the RIT offensive midfield, are you referring to the RIT offensive midfield in their settled offense, or are you referring to more of a transition and what RIT can do, you know, sub-game transition, et cetera?
Yeah, so it's kind of both. It's those guys coming in through the midfield with these – they call them Gator. I got the firsthand I got to hear it, because all their guys on the bench every single time they would have a step through were yelling Gator. And so that would tell them that they have a step in the midfield, and now we want to either get it to them or look to them as a cutter or whatever it is. And they're so good at that. And those guys are so fast coming out and so skilled and so slick. And then they're good feeders as well. You know, like, if you leave a skip for Barnable to throw where you're rotating from, like, he's going to do it. You know, they're really slick with that. And so it's kind of a combination of both. If you do your due diligence and you actually defend the sub games, then you still have to hunker down and defend them 6-on-6, because they do a really good job of getting downhill and forcing you to slide off those attackmen.
Now, I'm going to interject a little bit about Salisbury here. One thing that Jim Berkman said, you know, on this week's conference call with the coaches, you know, asking specifically about RIT's ability in transition and the sub game, he mentioned Christopher Newport and that he saw some similarities of what they did that he can kind of take away and apply to RIT, or at least, like, you know, it's not completely foreign to him. Is that something that you would agree with?
Slightly, I would say. I think RIT is obviously, like, another level of intentional about it, where they're doing it as I think of RIT for when you in terms of defending them. I think you have to think of it as three phases. Your initial phase, where they pick the ball up, they're thinking transition. Can we score a 43 fast break? You know, if they don't get through that, they can't push anything there. Now they're going to jump into their sub games, and you have to kind of defend that as the phase two. And then phase three becomes defending that 6-on-6 settled offense. And so, kind of to answer your question, defending phase one and two, defending phase one is definitely a very accurate representation of what CNU does, where they want to get the ball. They'll send pulls over. Their pulls are good at drawing. The first goal of the game in that CNU Salisbury game is Jack Cook stepping in from like 15 yards and just hammering one. And so they will send pulls over, and they'll do a good job of pushing that initial transition. And then they may, like, set a pick for the for a Dodger as an OVD and sub behind it or something like that. And so they'll do a little bit in there. But I would say RIT is another level of intentional in their sub games, and it's just practiced more. It's repped, it's repped, it's repped. And everybody on the field is on the same page because of it.
Now, I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, the 6-on-6 offense. And I just want to talk a little bit more about Larson Sundown, because he's a player that, you know, I really liked at Limestone. He's also a JUCO player. I believe he won a JUCO national championship as well.
Yes.
So he's won. He's won a hell of a lot of games in his career. And that's, you know, it's not always like something you can attribute to the individual, but there's something there when he's a guy who happens to be around winning programs. What did you see in person from him?
That's an awesome question. He is another level. And in that game, when push comes to shove, I had mentioned earlier that they were doing a little bit of splitting between him. Well, not a little bit. All season, they've been doing some splitting between him and Spencer Bell. When push came to shove, they were going to him more often. He was in the game, and they put the ball on his stick and let him make a bunch of decisions. And he's another level of just cool, calm, and composed. Like, we make it look like we talk about guys like Jared Barnhart who kind of make it look like at times like they're not trying, because it's just that they're another level of like composed, I would say. It's just that they're unflustered, and he totally fits that stereotype in that mold of like unflusterable, cool, calm, composed, has the ball on his stick and can just be like eating checks and reading the defense as he's doing it. He's really awesome. And when he's clicking, he's like, to your point, he may be one of the toughest attackmen in the country to stop. He's such a good feeder and can make you pay if you're going to him. But if you're not and you're going to be slow to go, he obviously reads that and can just kind of become the scorer that you need to be in that moment.
Yeah, Coach Kuhn this week on the call was, you know, talking about him, and, you know, he mentioned that like he fit in so well to this team, which, you know, you kind of think of like RIT and then, you know, Salisbury, and we'll talk about, you know, I'd say there's a key transfer that's worth keying in on them as well. But these teams had so many guys coming back. So you think of like, and they're teams that are national championship caliber teams before you add anyone to the roster. And you think of like what adding one guy, especially, you know, a guy who's going to become a starting attackman, like what can that do to your team chemistry? It can have such an adverse effect on your team. There's no doubt. There's one ball. And, you know, you have a lot of guys who want the ball.
Totally. And you could kind of tell that he was like one of the dudes the guys were totally getting down for. And Dawson Tate, too. He's like the lifeblood of that team. Every single time an RIT goal like happens, or as soon as the ball hits the back of the net, Dawson Tate was like jumping up in the air, hands up, screaming. Like, he wasn't talking trash. It wasn't like dirty. He was just genuinely super excited for his teammate that just scored. And if it was him that scored, then he was genuinely excited for whoever passed it to him. You know, he was an awesome person. I gave him some knucks after the game.
Yeah, so it just says so much about, like, you know, the character and the ability to and the coaching job that Jay Kuhn is doing in order to integrate such a key player at such a high level into the already awesome roster that they have. Now, let's talk about their polls a little bit. You know, I think RIT is historically like, you know, I don't know, maybe they get like more credit for their polls' ability to key transition than they don't get enough credit for their ability to just flat out defend. What did you see from all of them?
So I've been a huge Alex Maruna fan for a couple years now. He's definitely one of the best cover defensemen in our game right now. He's super simple, doesn't try and throw crazy checks, you know, and especially in years past, the RIT defenders have just had like incredible stick skills. Like, I think back to the year that they had Trevor Smith, who was an All-American, and then I'm forgetting his name, but they had two LSMs that were both just incredible. And
yeah, I mean, they're doing
unbelievable sticks
and like just bombing these 18-yard shots. They were just incredible. Yeah,
it's unbelievable. And then because they could do that, you like have to fly up the field, and so then they would step into it and like crow hop into a low to high pass that just goes straight to the pipe for a one-on-one. You're like, all right, that's literally undefendable. I don't know how anybody can do it. And so in years past, they've had those type of guys, and Maruna doesn't really fit that mold, and so he's kind of been a really good compliment for them for years. And then another guy that kind of has emerged, I would say, in the second half of the season as one of the better defenders in the country is Shume, the big, tall, lanky left righty. He wears number 25 for them, and he's been one of the guys that I don't know was getting a whole ton of credit at the beginning of the year, But as the season has progressed and that defense has gotten a bit better, they've gotten he's somebody that's getting a little bit more credit. And then in the midfield, Taylor Jensen, their LSM, was awesome in person. He was creating havoc all over the place and then was great off the ground. And was very timely with his slides and things like that, which as an LSM, you don't always get credit for. You're mostly looking at to, you know, spark transition and pick up a bunch of ground balls and stuff like that. But he was good within the team scheme of things too.
I'm going to ask you a question that is about both teams. Looking at their schedules, which team is more battle-tested at this point of the year?
That's a really good question. I think it kind of depends on how good you think CNU is. Because I think if you kind of, if CNU and Union played, which would be an awesome game, I'm not sure who wins. But RIT saw them twice, whereas Salisbury saw the other team, saw CNU, you know, four times, obviously. And then they were able to, you know, see Lynchburg early in the season, which was a tough one. But I'm not really sure outside of that. That's a good question. I would say it's pretty similar. I would say they're basically right on par. One thing that I think is pretty incredible about both teams that they are really similar, I think they're the two deepest teams in the country. Like from top to bottom, including like their ability to roll out another midfield or their ability to roll out three LSMs. Both teams are playing three LSMs at a time. You know, like I think that the two deepest teams in the country made the national championship.
Yeah, and I think that's across the board at all levels. We're seeing that.
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously the top, like all these guys have some of the best top end talent, but you know, you're seeing the teams that like go down into the double digits of double digit point scorers. And that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the position battle that I think a lot of people are going to focus on, and, you know, we're kind of linking from RIT into Salisbury here as we discuss, is at the faceoff X. This, I guess I'll put it this way, because like I don't think we can predict who's going to win the faceoff battle. Like I just don't think that like we know. I think they're both so high level. You know, maybe if we had Greg Aurelian on here, he'd give us a little more insight into that. But let's. Which team needs to win the faceoff battle more?
That's a great question. Man, you're on fire with these questions. I think that Malamphy is a little bit of a step down under the new rules. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why Salisbury has used Sweeney a bit. But I think that he thrives under the new rules. So I think they're going to be able to use both, which I think is going to force RIT to use both of their guys. So we're going to see a little bit more of a face-off battle and, you know, a bit of a X's and O's chess match at the face-off X than we may be expecting right now. And one thing that's really, really telling in person with Nick Montemurano was his stick skills once he picks the ball up. Like Tufts had a game plan going into it that they were thinking, okay, Helfrich may be able to go 50-50 with him. Montemurano, and he did for a time, but over the course of the game, Montemurano kind of started to assume himself. And then the game plan became jump him once he picks the ball up. And against a Tufts team that you can't turn the ball over in the middle of the field, Montemurano was awesome with the ball on the stick. And so I think that that's going to be some sort of advantage where Salisbury's not going to be able to pressure him and take the ball away from him afterwards. So they're going to need to rely on those guys to win to themselves. And I don't know that where I think that it's going to land, but I do think that it's going to be a little bit more of a, you know, team scheme thing and a group effort there than is going to be just the two of them going head to head. And then if it's close in the fourth quarter, that's exactly what we'll see. We're just going to see them rolling out their big dogs and letting them go at it. So it'll be interesting to see how it kind of plays out. But I think to start, whichever team can kind of find the advantage within their crew rather than their you know, headliner. Makes sense.
No, for sure. And if I remember this right, Montemurano is a Victor New York product.
The home that of Petey sounds Erland. Right to
home
me.
Petey Erland.
It does sound right to me.
I think so. But anyway, you know, kind of we'll shift into any closing thoughts about RIT?
Closing thoughts about RIT. Are you going to make me do a pick later in the game? Later in the
we'll pick pod? After we talk about them, we'll pick.
Okay. All right. Then no. Done for now.
Okay. Salisbury, the Seagulls, the team that wins championships all the time. You know, this is, you know, it's incredible that, you know, basically all the players who've been there for 4 years come out of there with a national championship. I guess that's a good point to start in the sense of, you know, this is RIT's third appearance. They haven't won it yet. You know, they had that loss to Stevenson back in the early 2010s, and then they had the loss to Salisbury just a few years ago. What do you make of the experience and the confidence that comes with it? And I say that because, like, you know, sometimes I think that's overrated in the sense that, you know, it's not always players on the roster who have, you know, it's not like every Salisbury player has won, 12 national championships?
Right.
Like, they haven't won 12. You know what I mean? Yeah. They, like, a lot of them have won one, you know.
Yeah.
There. But, like, I don't know. Like, so what do you make of the, like, experience, confidence factor going into this?
I think you're just that much more confident in your game plan going into it, and the fact that it's just kind of like built into your culture. Whereas, like, for RIT, it's an extra thing where you're kind of trying to get over that hump. But I feel like all of that goes away as soon as the first whistle blows. Like, once that first whistle blows and you get into the midst of things and the game kind of gets going, like, it's only going to matter so much. At that point, your best players have to go out and win you the national championship. And that's just kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's kind of the way that Jim Berkman put it, too, in the sense of he was talking about that and he said, you know who my director of ops is at the D3 level? My director of ops is Jim Berkman. So, like, you know, it comes down to the fact that, like, he knows what to do in the situation in terms of, like, there's a lot of stuff these guys have to go through that's different from a normal game. You know, there's, right. You know, there's not a media conference call the week before, you know, just any other D3 game. You know, this is the only time that it happens. You know, there's the banquets that are associated with it. There's the travel that's unique. There's the autograph signings. There's the media commitments once you get up there that you kind of have to, like, have someone who does all that. And, like, and Berkman's just done it so many times that, like, yeah. It's like nature to him. So maybe, like, it makes the 72 hours heading into the game a little bit smoother. But, yeah, like, once the whistle blows and the first face-off, I think that's all out the window.
Yeah.
But I'll ask you, and I think it's the same question I started with, the area of the field that is going to be key for Salisbury in this one. I think I asked the same question about RIT.
You did, and I think my answer is just the group that would be defending that RIT offensive midfield. You know, so defensively, I don't know who they're going to go short stick shut. I think you can kind of take your pick at the letter. You just pick whichever attackman between the three of them you think your short stick matches up best with. So whether it's because you have right-handed short stick defenders, you want them to go match up on a lefty so that his stick is in front, maybe that's your choice. Maybe you think that you can just put them on 22 or 12 and live with it and they're not going to be able to go by them. Like, I don't know what they're going to do, but I know that one of them is going to be short-sticked, and then they're going to go and bump up poles and get a pole on Rosenblum and get a pole on Barnable. And so then the last matchup becomes, can Marley Angus go by whichever one of the last short-stick D-middies is out there for Salisbury? And if he can, and Salisbury has to support him and go because Angus is getting to the middle and scoring, you know, unassisted goals, it could be, you know, trouble for him. But I think that that's a huge hinge point right there, is whoever that RIT wants to roll out with those other two, can that guy go by Salisbury's short stick?
Now, you've seen both of the teams from a sideline close up to the field view. You know, I haven't had that luxury. I haven't, you know, been covering games in person this year. But on film, Salisbury is freaking enormous.
They're giant.
They are just, they're animals in terms of just like, I mean, and there's like, you know, I mean, how many guys are 6'4 or above in their starting group?
Totally. A lot. Yeah.
Now, did you see, and seeing RIT, like, do you feel like that's going to be like a clear physical advantage for Salisbury?
I think it's so obvious when you go back and watch those Salisbury CNU games and like the way that Dowd and Brownwell are able to just kind of get to the middle at will on the CNU short sticks, or even Hines at that point, who like Phoenix Hines is a great player. He's better with his stick skills and speed and pushing transition, I think, than he is with his strength and like denying Jared Brownwell from getting to the middle of the field. And so those guys are able, it like is so clear in that game. I think we're still going to see a bit of it in this RIT game, but RIT's, specifically in the defensive midfield, is going to be a bit stronger and a bit bigger than those CMU short sticks were. So I think it still exists. I think it still is an advantage. And that manifests itself on 50-50 ground balls a ton. You know, like the bigger, stronger, faster team usually ends up winning the 50-50 count. So I think it could end up being, you know, one of those things where every time the ball hits the ground in the Salisbury defensive end, we see one of those poles running through it and picking it up. So we'll see how it all plays out. But I think we could definitely see Salisbury with a bit of an edge in the athleticism department.
I actually talked to Jack Dowd earlier doing a story with him and his inside the lineup at Salisbury, transferred from Furman. And, you know, kind of found a new home at Salisbury. He is such, like, you know, we're talking about Sundown. Like, he is such a prime, like, a transfer into a lineup and adding something so special to a team. You know, the ability to become, he's only a freshman in terms of eligibility, which is scary for the next several years for anyone who plays Salisbury. But it's a really, really veteran group. And for him to come in and earn a starting midfield spot, and not only earn the spot, but, you know, he has close to 50 points now, that is just insane. You know, he's a big guy. Like we said, I think he's about 6'5". His ability to kind of – and he said his skill is just, you know, it's what you ask of a midfielder. It's, you know, the ability to draw a slide and be able to get it to one of the attackmen for you know, in open space to make something happen. But he is such an awesome addition. You know, he's that typical guy who, he was in the transfer portal before Furman shuttered the program. So he was kind of already looking for a new home at that point. Had some Division I offers, you know, was going to play kind of mid-level D1 and, you know, got on a Zoom call with Jim Berkman and, you know, he made the sell. Like, hey, do you want to win a national championship? Do you want to have a lot of fun doing it? Come to Salisbury. And that sold him. And it's been awesome ever since for him. And the way he's kind of ingratiated into that team. You know, he said it's kind of fun. He said that after he didn't know how he measured up to these Salisbury guys. You know, he saw them on film and knew they were really good. But he didn't know where he'd slot in. He didn't know he was going to be a first-line midfielder. Nothing's guaranteed there. And he said at the end of the fall, Berkman gave him a call, and like I guess they have their players ranked in some way. That is, and he told him, he's like, you know, whatever his ranking was, it was like third on the team or something. And he's like, if you keep it up, you're going to be a starting midfielder for this team. So, you know, he kind of earned it in practice and earned his spot. He's a player that I think is exceptional and is going to have an awesome game. Obviously, Jarrett Bromwell. Like, those numbers are just video game numbers. I don't understand that at all. What did, like, how?
He's shooting the ball. Like, this is going to sound like a really just, like, caveman-y take, but it's the God's honest truth. I think he might be shooting the ball harder than anybody in the country right now. Like, goalies just aren't seeing the ball out of his stick, and next thing you know, it's by him. It's not like he's just hammering overhand, like, corners, and, like, he shoots it overhand. It's hard to read. It comes out of his stick fast, but it's not always, like, buried into the corner. It's just overwhelmingly hard and fast and on the goalie before they can react. And he just gets to the middle. Like, he gets to spots on the field where he has the whole cage to shoot at, too. So it's not like the goalie can kind of just hold on a pipe and then explode far pipe on the shot, knowing that, you know, that's kind of the place that everybody wants to go from there. Like, they have to wait and read and react to the ball because he's able to use his size and frame and just attack the middle of the field. And then he's a good lacrosse player, so when he gets slid to, he's able to, like, clear his hands and either throw it through or throw a feed inside. And the attackmen do a good job of moving for him. So, it's all really in rhythm for him, too, which it's been really good for the Salisbury offense to be able to rely on him as well as Ferreira as a Dodger. If Ferreira's matchup isn't quite what they want, they know that they can get the ball to Bromwell and he can attack and give them another spark.
Yeah, Bromwell shooting almost 50% on the year, which is just crazy at this point of the year right now. Salisbury's defense, you know, I think it's obviously the historic. When you think of Salisbury, I think in a lot of ways it's synonymous with defense. This is a very veteran group. You know, it's a group that's played a lot of minutes individually, but a lot of minutes together, which I think is the key part to that. Can they handle the slickness of RIT?
I think they can. I totally think that they will. They're going to have to support at times. And if they can be buttoned up on when they do and when they go, and just make sure that they're crisp and arrive on time, because as how tight RIT plays their offense, I wouldn't be surprised if they're arriving with checks to cause turnovers. And so they don't have to go and, like, pressure you all over the place, knowing that if they do slide, they're just going to be tighter in their slides to make it a little bit easier for them to get around. And the way that RIT plays offense, they're really good about swinging the ball around the horn once the defense gets rotating. And a lot of times that's adjacent, but Salisbury already slides adjacent. And so I think they're going to maybe be able to time that up and arrive on time and arrive with checks. And I think they're going to be buttoned up and kind of, urgent with all of it. So I think that it does match up well for them. I think that it's going to be one of those things where early in the game, if it gets defended well two or three times, RIT may be looking to get out and switch up the game plan a little bit and kind of go to a different style and a different approach. But it'll all be kind of dependent on those first couple possessions and how in tune Salisbury is with those rotations.
All right, I think we've kind of dissected the teams enough. Let's make some picks. Who is your Division III national champion?
So I'm in a pickle. I'm going to need your advice, actually.
Okay.
Because my heart wants to go with RIT. I think that they have this, like, really special thing going. Their energy is awesome, and they're in a spot where they've been knocking on the door, and it just feels like a time where they're going to get over the hump. They have pieces in place where they have, first-team All-American goalie. They have All-American face-off guy. They have a really good close defense unit. Their attack is loaded. They're really talented. I picked them at the beginning of the year to go and win it. So all of these things make me want to pick them. And then I look at Salisbury's team and I think about their defense and just the way that they're already programmed to play and the way that they're going to be able to already get those pulls up. I just think that that's going to make it really tough on the RIT offense. And so my brain tells me Salisbury, which is why I'm coming to you for advice. Do I go with my heart or my brain?
Always go with your heart.
Well, then my pick is RIT.
In everything, go with your heart. All right. I guess what we'll do then is I don't remember if I said Tufts or Salisbury at the end of the year, but I know I did not say RIT.
Yeah.
So I think I said, I don't know if we.
I also think it's time to give me a little bit of credit for picking CNU as my sleeper team.
This is true. You have been all about CNU. I remember, like, literally asking you, like, when we were doing prep, in the preseason, like, what's the team, what is the sleeper team? What is the team that, like, is, like, on the cusp that's really going to break through in a great way? And you said CNU.
Boom, you also final said, four.
You also said Catholic, which had an awesome game in the tournament. There's another team that you deserve credit for, too, that you kind of had on the radar.
I want to say you're thinking of Stockton, who ended up losing in their conference championship, but I do love me some Stockton.
Okay, yeah, but you've been kind of like identifying that team that is going up levels in terms of like what their status is.
I like that role. I could be that guy.
But I'm going Salisbury, and I've been called a I'm a Jim Berkman acolyte.
You're a Siegel lover.
Yeah, maybe it's just growing up. I mean, but you have the same, maybe it's the Maryland in me. They probably got a few curly guys on the roster, so yeah.
I'm going to be with a Salisbury alum and national champion and All-American from there during the game. So I think for his sake of his mood and things like that, it'll vary drastically if they win or lose. So maybe for that reason, I need to hope they win. I guess there's a spin zone for me no matter what happens.
Always look on the bright side. There are no Archbishop Curley guys on the Salisbury roster this year, but I know they've had a few in their time, including Cal Hartzell, who I played with at Curley.
Who's that?
Cal Hartzell. This is going way back. Never heard of him. Only the all-world, all-world defenseman who's won a gold medal and numerous championships. Played attack with me back in the day at Archbishop Curley High School.
Oh, wow.
Before we were a MIAA B conference contender. Those were the days when I think we had two conference wins my senior year, and that was like the Super Bowl for us.
And he was playing attack too?
He was playing attack. He was small then. He was my size. He was like, and I guess he hit a growth spurt when he was at Essex, and just kind of exploded, just incredible work ethic from there, and just really kind of like decided that like he wanted to be great at lacrosse and then did it. So that's a little bit of a left turn there, but anyway, Salisbury for me, like you said, like, and it's tough to like pinpoint a reason. But I will say this, it was 15-7 when they played in the championship back in 2017.
That was such a loaded Salisbury team.
Yeah, I do not think it's going to be that lopsided of a score. Yeah. I'm going to say it's a 3-goal game, but Salisbury wins.
I like that. It's a good take.
Close till late, and then, it's going to be a 3-goal game that feels like RIT can win it.
RIT at any given point could be down, in the Tufts game, it was 9-5, and you're like, oh man, things are not going their way. And then you blink and boom, it was 9-9. I'm telling you, it was like, I honestly think it was a four minutes of game time. So in real life, that's like probably 10 minutes. And you went from 9-5 to 9-9 going into the half. And it was just like they looked invincible. There were two runs in that game where RIT looks totally invincible. And if they play like that, they would be.
The perfect segue here to the Division II National Championship. Lenoir Ryan versus Lemoyne. Speaking of teams that can go on epic runs, both of them. Lemoyne against Mercyhurst, it was a close game. And then Lemoyne went, kind of just like, did its thing. And Lemoyne is just so like efficient and steady.
Yeah. And they have these like consistency vibes that Salisbury gives.
Right. So like, and sometimes that like manifests itself into scoring 5 goals straight. You know what I mean? Like they're like a team that like, is going to go on runs, but not chaotic runs. It's going to be just like, we've been doing the same thing that we've been doing the whole game, but it's just working for us now. They did that against Mercyhurst, which was the number one scoring offense in Division II. Lenoir Ryan is a team that their semifinal match was a little lopsided. They kind of took it to Wingate, who's a conference rival. It was the third time that they were playing. But in their quarterfinal game, they were down 7-1 to Tampa, and a Tampa team that just had so much talent, and they just like have this like, Coach Paradine was talking this week about his wife arrived a little bit late to the game. And he said she was freaking out because, like, she got there, like, she was parking the car, and it was like 5-1. And then, like, by the time she got in the stadium, it was 7-1 Tampa. And she's like, what's going on here? But then, like, they, you know, he said, we don't blink. You know, it's a team that just, they came back from that. And, you know, they just have that way about them that at any given moment, they can just uncork a bunch of goals in a row. So, yeah, we'll talk about this game. You know, I don't know. Which team do you want to talk about first?
Let's go with LeMoyne first.
Okay. You know, everything that I've always said about Jim Berkman is also true about Dan Sheehan, in the sense that, like, he's the best that he is at his level. There is a steadiness and a consistency and a attention to detail and expectation that he kind of demands of his players. And I'm not saying it as, like, you know, like, there's a difference between being a demanding coach and demanding expectations. I don't know if that makes any sense, what I'm trying to say there. But, like, you go there and you know you have to be playing at a championship level the entire time that you're there, because, you know, someone else will take your spot. There's, you know, a lot of players who want to play for LeMoyne, and you need to have that consistency. I think that it is a matchup that is easy to say that it's offense versus defense. Lenore Ryan being the offensive juggernaut this year, LeMoyne just kind of always having, you know, this hallmark of consistent defense. And that's true to some extent, but I think it's selling LeMoyne's offense short a little bit. And I want to talk about Matt Hutchings. You know, he's a guy that, you know, he was a little bit banged up earlier in the year, missed some games due to injury. He is fully back now. In the game against Mercyhurst, he had 2-5. In the game against St. A's a week prior, you know, he had 3-4. So 7 points in both games here. And, like, that's incredible in its own right. But, like, you know, to me, he's the guy that, like, you know, I don't think, like, he's going to blow by you by any means. But he's, like, that really steady. He's like a Jackson Morrill type, in the sense that, like, just real smart lacrosse player. Like, he can get by you. It's not like he doesn't have the ability. He's just not, like, going to be known for that blistering speed. But he makes everyone around him so much better. And then they've got a great transfer in Jake Nelson. You know, he's Scott Nelson's son. Scott Nelson, who's actually helping out on the staff. Jake Nelson's been at a number of places, but found his home at LeMoyne. And he's got 24 goals in this year. So, you know, I think it's a team that, like, is underrated in its offensive ability. I think for whatever reason, people, like, just assume that LeMoyne is going to beat every team 6-4. And they can do that. And that's an awesome, like, ability to be able to gut out those wins. Is something that I don't know, like, if Lenore Ryan has that ability in them. But, like, I also think that LeMoyne can run and gun, too, in the sense that it's a more controlled – they can put up points, but they're not going to, like, play chaotic. Right. You know?
Go ahead. I think about that Adelphi game earlier in the year that was that 15-14 double overtime where, like, they needed to get to 15 goals and just kind of keep matching because, you know, they couldn't get the stops they needed and their offense was able to get those high-pressure 6-on-6 goals.
Yeah, and, like, and the way they did it was, like, you know, Adelphi, they made a great gutsy play in their defensive end. Adelphi kind of, like, got a little too careless with the ball. LeMoyne made a gutsy play. And just, like, did, like, they made a fundamental transition goal and won the game. And that's just, like, how LeMoyne's going to do it. Their defense is awesome. You know, it's going to be, like, the only defense this year that I think can slow down Lenore Ryan. And I don't think they're going to go after you and try to take the ball away. You know, I think they're just going to, like, they're a team that, like, people don't realize how good the shot clock has been to a team like LeMoyne. You know, they've been, like, able to, with, like, in past years before the shot clock, they've been so good that they've been able to, like, frustrate offenses for, like, 3 minutes where they're just, like, they're playing defense and they're not, like, taking the ball away. They're not being disruptive, but like the offense just like flat out can't do anything. But you can have only so many of those possessions where you're playing defense for that long and your offense just never sees the ball. So the shot clock has been good of like, oh, we only have to defend for 80 seconds. That's easy for us. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of reasons that LeMoyne is a very complete team. Colin Sipek, and I'm sorry, I know I'm pronouncing his name wrong, is an awesome player, two-way guy, does everything middle of the field, can score if you need him, can play defense if he gets back there. And LeMoyne's short sticks are always just so good. You know, that's like a hallmark of the team. I think whenever they've won the national championship, they've had a short stick defensive midfield matchup that has just been at another level. You know, I think when they shut down Limestone's Colton Watkinson in that national championship game, they just have that ability to – Dan Sheehan recruits that position at a high level. He doesn't just let someone become a short stick D-mate. Now, Lenore Ryan is – I don't know. They're like the – they're not a Cinderella because, like, even though they've never won it before – you know, we were talking early in the year in this podcast about Lenore Ryan having national championship potential. Their team that's just been like, you know, they're about to make that next step. They made the step into the, you know, the national championship game. They've never been to this spot before. They've been in the semifinals before, but never to the national championship game. Now they're there. And now it's, you know, just a matter of like who's going to execute better on game day. But this is a team that's it's going to run and gun. They want to score goals. Coach Paradine put it pretty like bluntly about the fact that like we are going to try to score goals. LeMoyne is going to try to keep us from scoring goals, which I know is like the most like Captain Obvious statement in the world because that's what every team does. But like that's what it's going to come down to. They've got an awesome face-off guy. And, you know, if you're not familiar with D2, watch Eric Dickinson play. He's just an incredible talent. He's a guy that could have gone D1 in this kind of weird year of transfers and you know, the COVID shutdown and all that stuff. He decided to stay and finish it out at Lenore Ryan and hopefully win a national championship. And, you know, he's definitely been as advertised. He's definitely got to be a first-team All-American. He does everything. He plays behind the net, plays in front of the net. You know, Paradine said that if he needed him to play D midi, he could. He's that athletic. You know, he doesn't use him like that, but he could do it. He's the best player at everything. He's the best player to ever play at the Lenore Ryan. He's a big reason that they're where they're at. Miles Moffitt is kind of his partner in crime. You know, he's a little more of like a steady hand, whereas Eric Dickinson is kind of the guy who's the headliner. But Lenore Ryan defensively is like, you know, they're not all offense. Defensively, they're going to be more aggressive than LeMoyne. They're going to try to get the ball on the carpet. They're going to try to make some stuff happen in transition. So, you know, in that way, it is a contrasting of styles. But my overarching point is just that, like, don't discount LeMoyne and their ability to score goals and play an offensive game. So yeah. It's going to be a fun one.
Yeah, it's going to be an awesome one. And you're totally right about Eric Dickinson. One thing, I was doing some stat hunting earlier. One thing that kind of jumps off the page, 80 points, 25 turnovers.
Mm-hmm.
25 turnovers with the amount that the ball is in his stick is pretty incredible. And then their attack, that unit, is lethal. They all three of them have over 100 shots on the season, led by Dickinson, who has like 140. But that's a ton of shots. That's a unit that, you know, is clicking. And you're not just orchestrating those shots and shooting anywhere or, like, you know, crappy angles playing for Coach Paradine. Like, you're working for good shots. You're not just pulling up and taking these crappy angles or anything like that.
Yeah, so, like, you know, it's fun. Like, and I wrote about it today on InsideTheCross.com, so just definitely give it a read. Like, you can't help but, like, you know, I'm not going to say root for them because, like I said, my fondness for LeMoyne and what Dan Sheehan has done up there, I never root against the guy. But Lenore Ryan is a great story in the sense of, like, watching a team break through is always super fun. And seeing the crowd shots in their stadium has been awesome.
Those pictures are incredible.
Yeah, like, it's like, that's like, that's what athletics does. You know what I mean? Like engaging a student, there's nothing else that engages a student body like something like that. And to see it, like, they've already sold out their allotment of tickets in East Hartford, which is pretty incredible. The alums have been dying for this. So, like, they're going to win the tailgate, I think, for sure. It's a matter of can they win the game.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting. That attack really, really, really leads this offensive group in points. It's a pretty significant drop-off after that. Between the three of them, it goes 80, 76, 62. And then the next leading scorer has 36 points. So it's a pretty significant drop-off there. So for LeMoyne, it's going to be all about, you know, keeping those three guys off the scoreboard as much as possible and forcing, you know, Bryce Reese and Kyle Hatcher to kind of do the damage through the midfield.
Yeah, so, like, it's funny. Like, I look back to, I want to say it was the 2016 National Championship game. They played Limestone. I want to say it was 7-4 or 8-4 that LeMoyne beat Limestone in that game. I called it, brownsaa.com. Dan Sheehan completely reinvented his team. He didn't reinvent, he did everything within the framework of their team, but like matchup based, like, you know, he put a guy behind the net who'd never played behind the net all year. He made a decision to short Limestone's best player. And like, it was just like all of the stuff that he did, all of it worked. And it took an offense that is just, that was just like breaking records left and right. And they scored 4 goals. So like, part of me is like, is that what is going to happen this game? I've seen it before. Clearly I called the game. I would not be surprised if that's what happened. But, like, I guess let's just go right into our picks. Despite that, I'm going with Lenore Ryan. Basically, like, I do think that LeMoyne is going to slow them down and they're going to have to gut out this win as opposed to if they get down like they did against Tampa, they're not going to come back. They're not going to do like Wingate and just kind of roll through the game. They're going to have to, like, be steady and productive throughout 4 quarters if they're going to win this. I think they can do it. I just kind of have a little bit of a Team of Destiny vibe for this team, so that's why I'm going with them to pick this one.
Yeah, they do kind of feel like a Team of Destiny after that performance in the Tampa game, for them to kind of come back and do what they did in that game and actually, you know, pull it out. It wasn't like they just came back and made it a close one. Like, they came back and won from down 7-1. It's incredible.
Yeah. And they were down at the half, too. Like, it was 7-1 early, but then I think they were down by a handful of goals in the third quarter as well. Who do you have?
I think I'm going to go with the opposite. I think I'm going to take the consistency. So I guess I'm kind of considering my D3 pick, going with the, I don't think we're going to have two non-winners, you know, that have never come through. So I'm going to take the consistency of LeMoyne, and I'm going to take the heart of RIT.
So, like, kind of, you're doing, yeah. I didn't follow my own advice for the first one, and I went with my head. This one, I'm going with my heart, I think.
Yeah.
I'm going with the gut that it's going to be the team that's the newcomer, the fun story, the all that stuff is what I'm using as my deciding factor for this. Who knows? Yeah. I've been terribly wrong in all of my picks all year. So hedge against me if you're making bets on this.
Yeah, I haven't been keeping track of my picks, so I guess I can't say one way or another. I do know that my preseason picks are all still alive in North Carolina. I think I had Lenore Ryan preseason. I know I told Kyle I had a future on him like halfway through. So I'll just go ahead and say that that was from preseason 2.
And I've been the one who, you know, when Kyle was on here and Kyle would help us with the rankings, I was always the one who was saying, no, LeMoyne is the number one team in the country. LeMoyne is the number one team in the country. Yeah. Even when, like, they didn't play, you know, early in the year, or like they had, you know, they had a stretch where they didn't have as many good games and stuff like that. I was like, no, LeMoyne is number one.
I was worried about them. They had the two overtime back-to-back games to Bentley was the second one and Adelphi was the first. And those two back-to-back games, I'm like, I'm a little worried. You know, I don't know that we should that they should be going to overtime in those instances. But that was a tough, gritty Bentley team this year that know, made some noise.
Yeah, Max Adler, the Bentley grad.
Yeah.
He actually texted me during that game. Shout out to Max Adler, who is a friend of the program, and was like, he texted me. He was like, make sure you're watching this Bentley game because Bentley's up on the one right now. So that only emboldened my confidence in them. The fact that they like had a close call and were able to gut it out twice in a row. And that was, I think it was in a span of maybe 2 or 3 days that they played both those games. Right. It was kind of like, and I knew they had injuries and stuff like that. So I was kind of like, all right, that's just like, this is a tough Lemoyne team. You know, like even when they like kind of have their off day, they're still going to finish it out. So you're going to talk me out of my pick just by having this discussion here.
That's the beauty of national championship game. It's, you know, the two best teams in the country fighting it out. Nobody really knows how it's going to unfold.
And my D1 pick is out. I had Notre Dame. I thought that their transfers that they brought in did the best job of filling holes that they had on the roster. Whereas, like, I thought a lot of other teams just added more talent.
Yeah,
they
did more depth, right?
Yeah, like, we need a better faceoff guy. We got a better faceoff guy. We need a third defenseman, et cetera. And I might go over with my picks. But we'll see. There's still the D2 and D3 championship to go. And, you know, obviously in women's, I think everyone in the world picked UNC at the beginning of this year, given that roster. So
yeah,
we'll see how that shakes out. This has been fun. Any parting words or anything? Or like, I guess we'll leave you this. Why watch these two games on Sunday?
Why watch these games? To see history. Gosh, come on. It's going to be historic. You got to be a part of it. Come on. Get on board.
It's always – they're always the D2 and the D3 games. One of them every year is maybe not the best or the second best game of the weekend without fail every year, including the men's D1 semifinals on Saturday. There's – one of these games is always going to be one that steals the show, so you do not want to miss it. Tune in to NCAA.com and watch it. We will, I imagine we'll come back with our All-Americans soon. And, you know, we'll at least hit you up with one more podcast after the national championship game. And then we'll kind of figure out our summer plans from there. But Dan, how can people follow you?
On Twitter at dkaplan46.
And I am at Matt Kinnear. And that's a wrap for this one. We will see you on Sunday. Spread the word around.